Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome to the show today. We have with us from Arizona, Mr. Zach Lind. Zach, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be on the show.
I think I'm supposed to introduce you and say that you are a part of the platinum or gold selling band Jimmy World. Am I supposed to do that?
You can if you want, but you know, you could just say I'm a drummer in a rock band, and yeah. The band's called Jimmy Eat World. But yeah,
yeah, I don't really even know what platinum and gold. I'm not really a musically inclined person, so I just think that's a way of saying that you are an important, worthwhile person that we should listen to.
Yeah, basically, platinum and gold are just sort of like sales markers. So, like, if you sell 500,000 records, it's gold.
Okay.
And if you sell 1,000,000 records, it's platinum.
Well, so. Good job on that. Well done.
Thanks.
Well done. Well, there are plenty of people who can talk about music. I am not one of them. Otherwise, we'll have some really awkward questions. So we're not even going to talk about that. But one of the things I really am interested with you is your take on Christianity, because you're a very fun person to follow on Twitter because of your take on a lot of things related to church and Christianity. So I think I read somewhere that you grew up in what you would call a conservative Baptist family, but that's probably not where you would self-identify your own religious inklings now, right?
No, I mean, I grew up in a conservative Baptist church. My dad was the son of a preacher, a Baptist minister. So yeah, I mean, my dad's sister and her whole side of their family, like she went to Bob Jones. And she met her husband at Bob Jones. All of her kids went to Bob Jones. So like on my dad's side of the family, pretty hardcore conservative, Baptist. And my dad, I think because he was really good at baseball, he played baseball and got drafted out of college, to play baseball. So he felt like that was his calling. Otherwise he probably would have, done the same thing, go to Bob Jones or become a minister or something like that. So yeah, I mean, and then, but my parents were all, really nice and supportive and great, but they just sort of operated in that conservative Baptist mindset. It was just, that was kind of where I came from.
Is that,
but now, yeah, I wouldn't self-identify as that now. No.
Is that still the type of Christian tradition your family is connected with? Your parents, that is?
Yeah, my parents still go to the same church. My parents are great. I think that they're, in a lot of ways, I think that my sort of leaving that way of thinking isn't so much a reaction to how my parents parented. Mm-hmm. It's just the kind of things I sort of soaked up when I was in that church culture. And
like what?
Like just, things that, just the sort of, like when I was a kid, I was a huge music fan, obviously. And just, they played this video called Hell's Bells, The Dangers of Rock and Roll, to all the junior high kids. And I started watching that and thinking, this is bullshit. Like that was like the light bulb went off in my head. Like, I think I'm being told stuff that's just like not right or not true. And so I'm going to start I think my skepticism started there, when they tried to tell me that Bruce Springsteen's I'm on Fire is a song about pedophilia. Then I sort of started to think, okay, maybe this, maybe there's elements of this that are not true. So let me sort of put on my, thinking cap here for a second. And I think from there on, it just sort of the general and not even so much a Baptist framing of the gospel, but just a sort of conservative evangelical framing of the gospel, started to make less and less sense to me. So
okay, so you're skeptical. They're hating on the boss and on AC/DC, and you realize there's something wrong with this. And so you have skepticism. But how do you fuel that skepticism inside of you? What are the things you're consuming to kind of keep you on that track and moving in a different direction?
Well, I think for a while I sort of pulled myself away from, you know, being involved in church a lot. You know, it's weird. Like, it, mentally, psychologically, I think I sort of checked out a little bit. But
how old were you then when you were checking out?
Probably like high school age, you know, yeah. Early in high school, like my sophomore year, junior year, I started to kind of think, okay, I'm not really, I had friends that went to that church. I grew up in that church. So I had friends. So I still was sort of involved. I would go and be involved, but I sort of thought like, you know, I'm not necessarily going to, you know, fly the flag. You know, I was just going to hang out with my friends and sort of, assimilate in the culture that I was in, but also in high school and after high school, and then being in a band and traveling and sort of seeing the world, you start to like, you know, you start to do the math and you start to figure out, okay, well, you know, there's sort of a lot here I have to unlearn. But yeah, that was sort of, you know, it's kind of started in high school and then progressed through, you know, even after I graduated and started touring in Jimmy Eat World.
So that was right out of high school. I think, did you start the band with a guy that you grew up with, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Our band started in my senior year and then we continued on after that.
So you started touring right after high school? Is that how it got started?
Pretty close. I mean, we, within the first year after graduating, we'd done some small tours and traveling around and nothing major, but just, you know, enough to kind of get out there and you know, play small clubs and bars, you know, all over sort of the West Coast. And, we did a little bit of touring in Texas, but yeah.
Cool. So what were you seeing that was causing you to kind of open your eyes? Anything that you can remember that was a really, impactful moment that helped you open your eyes?
Well, I think, I don't know if there are like specific moments, you know, it was just sort of a sense that like, you know, here I'm supposed to sort of understand the world in the sense of like, if you are believe certain things, then you're not going to go to hell. And if you don't believe certain things, then you will go to hell. Right. So the sort of basic understanding of, you know, what it was all about, and then going out in the world and then meeting a bunch of people that had no interest in what you believed, you know, never really had any interest in that or whatever. But you meet them and they're really great people. They're nice people. You start to live life with people outside of your bubble, and you realize, at least for me, it was like, this just kind of doesn't make sense, you know, like, and I think as a kid, you know, like when I was a kid, I always thought, you know, they always said, you know, you got to share the gospel with your friends. And, you know, and I always kind of felt like, well, I always sort of felt hesitant because I think, man, that's just kind of like a shitty thing to say to someone. Like, you know, if you don't believe what I believe, then I'm really concerned for you and you're probably going to go to hell. I mean, I think that just sort of started to unravel for me just through everyday life of being outside of that, that world and in the world of being on the road in a van and playing clubs and bars and stuff.
So what were you, if you're decompressing and getting rid of some of the things you were indoctrinated with growing up, what were you starting to read or listen to that was giving you a new perspective on Christianity and spirituality?
Right, yeah. It probably wasn't until about 2001, you know, a handful of years later after I'd, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years later after I graduated, but, you know, I'd remained somewhat, like for whatever reason, I think one of the reasons is because I play drums, but, you know, I always sort of like got asked to play drums in worship services. And, you know, the guy who was the worship pastor at, that I met my wife at a church Bible study. So I sort of stayed in the constellation of, you know, sort of Christian, the institution of Christianity.
Same church or different church?
Different church. Yeah. Okay. Different church. So, and you know, the worship pastor at my wife's church, was a really nice guy and helped me out a lot. And, He actually recorded our first demo, Jimmy Eat World's first demo, in the sanctuary of that church. And so, you know, he was, you know, he was a good guy, nice guy, and he would like hit me up to like fill in every once in a while on a weekend if he needed a drummer. And so I would stay involved through music and just kind of trying to be reciprocal to my friends who've helped me out. And then I met my wife, so she was pretty rad. And so I hung out with her, and I kind of ended up going to church just kind of to hang out with her. And, but probably wasn't until like 2001 where, one of the pastors at that church who I was friends with said, "Hey, you should check out," like, my, you know, he gave me the names of Rob Bell, Brian McLaren, folks like that. And I started listening to Rob Bell sermons. I started, reading some books, and that was the first time where I was like, "Oh, okay, this makes sense. This is something I can get invested in."
So, McLaren, was it like A New Kind of Christian? Was that the book?
Yeah, so New Kind of Christian, and then just listening to Rob's sermons. It was, I mean, that's when I sort of started to realize, oh wait, there's a version of this that I can actually grasp and feel good about and understand and move forward with. So I think from then on, I got really interested in sort of different people who are sort of framing the gospel in a different way than I had understood it when I, you know, growing up as a kid.
So you're still in the same hometown, right? You're still Phoenix area, right?
Yeah, I live in Phoenix. I live about maybe 25 minutes from where I grew up.
So you obviously are not a part of the church you grew up in. You're part of a different church now.
Mm-hmm.
What type?
Yeah, we go to a Mennonite church in Glendale, actually, which is about a 25 minute drive from us.
Is that where Shane Hipps was?
That's right. Yeah. So initially started going there because of Shane, and then, you know, we just stuck around, you know. We've tried to find churches that are closer by in our neighborhood, but we just haven't found anything that felt good and was a good fit for us. So I think, you know, we just sort of make the trek over to the Mennonite church every Sunday.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but Shane Hipps and I are actually best friends. He came on the podcast, and I tweeted that Shane Hipps is my new best friend when I linked the podcast, and he retweeted it. So according to Twitter, Shane and I are best friends.
Yeah.
He seems like a great guy. Have you kept up with him?
He is a great guy, yeah. He's a guy I've learned a lot from, and you know, he's such a sharp mind and an intelligent person. So yeah, I mean, he has a lot to offer, and he's helped me a lot, you know, for sure.
What do you think about him not being a pastor right now? He's obviously still doing things in the kingdom, but he's now obviously doing different things 9 to 5 during the week usually.
I think it makes sense. You know, I think that Shane is a very sort of progressive thinker, and I think the current Christian culture and conventional wisdom of Christianity is a tough place for Shane to thrive. So I think that what he's doing now and not being limited by not being limited by the constraints of American Christianity is probably a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I had probably about a 30 or 40 minute talk with him after the podcast was over, and as someone who's a pastor, I want Shane Hipps having a voice in a church every Sunday. I mean, I'm obviously a homer. I'm a pastor, so I want everyone who can preach to be in a sermon giving mode. But yeah, I get that. No, but I still hate him not being a pastor right now.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting. He went to Mars Hill, which is probably one of the more progressive, you know, mega churches around. And, you know, it just wasn't, I think Shane just is, it's funny. I think Shane and Rob, when they were preaching, were often talking about the same themes, about the same ideas. But I think Rob, being from that culture and being from, you know, Grand Rapids in that area, sort of knew how to communicate something that was challenging but didn't cause anxiety. And I think Shane, you know, if you spend any time with Shane or listen to his sermons are fairly direct, and you know, they're, you know, he brings his ideas with a lot of strength behind them, and I think that freaks people out. Even though I think if, you know, Shane and Rob were to talk about their idea, you know, their fundamental understanding of the gospel and what to, you know, and the things that they like to teach about, they would be totally on the same page. It was just a sort of stylistically, I think that, you know, it was a tough fit for Shane. And, you know, I totally get his sort of feeling of like, you know, if I can't make it work here, then I'm probably not going to be able to like, you know, do anything meaningful or significant. So he moved on.
Wow. That's terrible. That's terrible. But I mean, I hate that for him. I completely respect his decision and where he's coming from, but, you know, for the kingdom wise, man, I'd love to have his voice to be more prominent, because I think he has really good stuff to say in his book, Selling Water by the River. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I went to a concert of yours. I think it was 2002. You guys were playing with Blink-182 and Green Day. Mm-hmm. And you guys came to Dallas. I was living in West Texas in Abilene. Drove in with my roommates to the concert. We go to the concert. I'm sitting there, and my roommates strike up a conversation with the young lady sitting next to us. And one thing leads to another. And they say, oh, yeah, my buddy over here, he's a preacher. And so the girls, I'm not sure if they were in all their mental faculty at the time, but mm-hmm. they lean over and go, you're a preacher. What are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Which is okay, whatever. So there's obviously a view of Christianity that's being proposed in that simple question, but I'm sure that's a kind of a question that you probably deal with all the time as a Christian in a rock and roll industry. Is that a question that you get annoyed with?
Yeah, you know, it's not something that I deal with a lot lately. You know, I think, but yeah, when I was going to, you know, when the church that my wife and I met at, that was sort of it's basically a fairly moderate, moderate to conservative sort of mega church. And there were a lot of great people there, but that was a question I, you know, people would come up to me and, they would say, man, I'm really praying for you. You're out there in the really dark places and, you know, the dark world of rock and roll. And, you know, and I think that sentiment came from a good place. You know, it was they were concerned and they were concerned for me. But in the end, like I sort of felt like, man, I wish someone would pray for me while I'm at church, because it seems so much, it seems a lot darker here.
What do you mean? How
just,
so?
Just, you know, like, I don't know, just, I mean, I could go on and on, but it's just the sort of, you know, just the things that back then it was just sort of like all of, you know, like just things like, I don't know. I probably shouldn't get too specific, but.
Okay, fair enough. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. So we've been talking about doing this podcast. I think we started talking probably last year, probably in December. Mm-hmm. And we weren't able to put things together. And until just recently, but 2 weeks ago, Richard Beck, a friend of the show, had a post on his blog entitled On the Christian Celebrity. And as soon as I read that, I thought, I want to talk to Zach about this. And lo and behold, I get a message from you just a few days later, which I like to think that is ESP work. And I've somehow put something in your head saying, reach out to Luke and let's talk about this.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
If you haven't read the blog post, the basic synopsis is he compares celebrity versus popular. And he says, popular means you're on a stage, people want to listen to you, means you're talented, whether, you know, you're a preacher, you're a musician, whatever it is, it means you're just talented, and so people want to listen to you. And there's nothing wrong with being popular. It's morally neutral. But right. Celebrity, in his definition, is a negative thing. And that comes from the disposition that you have towards others. And let me just read a quote from it. Connecting with the crowd before and after is an act of solidarity, hospitality, humility, and service. The speaker is making themselves available, and that availability is the exact opposite of celebrity. Celebrity is about the size of your ego, your heart, and the welcome you extend to others. Okay, so in Beck's world, he creates popular, morally neutral, celebrity is a bad thing. So as a person who would be in a band that many people would consider to be popular, I was interested in your take on his write-up.
No, I think what he's getting at is you know, I think it's good what he's saying. The distinction between popular and celebrity, it makes sense to me. I think it's just, you know, I think the sort of the way that he's measuring whether someone is a celebrity or not is a little unfair to some degree. You know, like, for instance, like, and I think there's a bigger issue here. I think it, you know, for me, celebrity, the difference between celebrity and popularity is primarily begins with the motivation of the artist or the speaker or the writer or whatever. You know, if you spend enough time with someone or you kind of get a sense for who someone is, you can tell that they're doing what they're doing because not to be a celebrity, but because they love what they're doing and they're good at it and they, you know, that's their gift to give. And, but they do it with humility and, it's sort of, they're motivated by being good at what, you know, what they do and all that stuff. And then celebrity is a little different where you can have all those components, but then it becomes, you know, your primary motivation isn't so much your work. It's the results of your work. You know, it's the fact that, oh, well, I get status and notoriety. I get money, I get fame. So, and it's hard to look at a person, you know, and know exactly what their motivations are. But I think that, you know, to say that if someone does a talk or preaches a sermon and then doesn't hang out afterwards, I understand what he's saying, but it sort of depends on the context. Like if you're going somewhere and giving a talk, you know, at a conference and, you know, it's easier to like get off the stage and hang out and have people like talk to you. And if you're, but if you're preaching a sermon and you have multiple sermons to preach that day or something, you know, there's some pastors out there preach five sermons, you know, which is crazy to me. I think that's nuts. But like that takes an incredible amount of energy and, you know, mental space. So I think that in that situation, I would sort of advise the person to not talk to anybody. Yeah. You know, but I would also ask like, you know, why are you, you know, why are you preaching five sermons? You know, that I think that's a little weird, but you know, I think that there's a big difference between, you know, between different contexts. And I think in certain situations, like for instance, the other thing I wanted to say is that the motivation of the admirer also matters a lot too. So like, let's say you and I went to go see Richard speak at a conference. You know, there's probably going to be maybe 1,000 people at the conference, maybe not. You know, it's not going to be like we're going to Catalyst, right? We're not going to Catalyst in a big arena. We're going to like a ballroom somewhere in some hotel. We're going to go listen to Richard Beck speak. And because you and I are huge fans of Richard Beck, we're going to want to go like say, hey, you know, I've never met him, but I'd love to go say, hey, man, I love your work. Thank you. And we'd be approaching him because we admire his work. Right. You and I aren't going to be approaching him because it makes us feel more important, or it gives us a sort of status or a story to brag to our friends about. No, we're meeting him because we appreciate what he does. And as someone like in my experience, like we played when we first started playing, we would be playing in small clubs. And if five people showed up, you know, maybe 10 people might show up, you know, and we also didn't have a tour bus. We didn't have like much of like small clubs don't really have like backstage areas. So we're basically there hanging out in the venue at the bar or around the, you know, sort of maybe in shops and places around the venue. And, you know, because of the sort of more intimate setting we'd strike up friendships or conversations with fans that are sort of like, those are friendships that in some cases we still have today. Like we'll go to that city and that person will come and we'll hang out with them. But I think because of the size and the scope of the event and the sort of just the nature of the show, we made these connections and these interactions are a little bit more based on the fact that they're not coming to us because they're going to go back to our friends that they came to a Jimmy World show because no one cared about us at that point in time. They're coming because they like our music, you know? And so now it's like we're playing, well, we'd play for, you know, let's say we're, you know, LA, and we're playing like a 2,500 capacity theater. And it's different because, if we wanted to go and interact with all of our fans, it would take just logistically, it's not easy. And also, like, there's a different dynamic to the interactions we have with most people because it shifts from, I want to say hi to you and tell you I appreciate your work to, I want to get a picture with you and I want to tell, whatever. It becomes more of like an intersection of an admirer because of celebrity in their own mind, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that those interactions are much more, I think because those interactions are a lot more draining.
Yeah. I can imagine that because in a lot of ways they're kind of using you. They use you to propel themselves up a social ladder. And I think if we're honest, a lot of us have done that in different settings, maybe innocuously or maybe intentionally, whatever. Yeah. And so I get that from your perspective. I obviously never experienced that because, like I said, I'm never going to be in a band. But does that – I mean, that's obviously on them, their intentions. But the way you respond to that, I think what Beck would say is that by not being available to them, even if they're going to, quote-unquote, use you, that you're pulling away from them and you're pulling away from people, all people. Because can you really tell beforehand exactly what someone's intentions are going to be?
No, I mean – and it's – it's not so much like to say I'm gonna write this person off who's waiting by our bus to get a signature because their motivations are bad. You're gonna say hi to them anyway. It's just that I think that there's a meaningful difference between those two scenarios, and it's like a good example is like Rob Bell. Like there was a point in time where he literally, just for his own well-being, had to decide not to make himself available like before and after his sermons, because he's preaching three times on Sunday, and the height of Mars Hill, there was probably like 10,000 people coming on a weekend. So that's a totally different thing than like speaking at a conference and there being 500 people there,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And you only speak once and you can,
So how do you draw the line between self-care, which you need to do? You can't do your art. You can't be present for people if you're completely drained. How do you balance between being responsible with the gift you have so that you can continue to give it and still, being a genuine human being and actually like caring about the people around you? How do you balance that?
I think that's tough. I mean, like, I think obviously, I think regardless of who you are in that situation, I think it's to Richard's point, and I agree with that, like, you have to make yourself available. You have to figure out a way to connect with people. That it just may not be the best time right after you speak or right before you speak, So like in a church setting, I would say as a teacher who, there might be pastors out there who get a lot of energy from those interactions. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And there's probably pastors out there that don't. And, that's fine too. I would just think that in their particular context, they need to figure out a way to make themselves available to the people who they're pastoring, who they're ministering to.
Yeah.
I think that there's, that's up to the pastor. But I think that people, rather than say, well, if they don't do this, if they don't hang out after they talk or before they talk, or if they don't stick around and listen to other speakers, like I get what Richard's saying. Mm-hmm. But, I think the spirit of what he's saying is correct. But it's just a matter of like determining whether or not someone has that mindset. Like, are they trying to just be a celebrity, or are they trying to just, you know, do their job, even though they're popular. And I think that before and right after they have to do their work and teach, it might not be the best time to say,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I've heard Seinfeld say that after he gets off stage, he doesn't talk to people. And I don't know if he was just saying metaphorically this is what he does or what he literally does, but he said he stole this from someone where he would literally wash his face as a symbolic act of kind of removing the exaggerated personality he puts on when he goes mm-hmm. on stage. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a way to like decompress for him for the 5 minutes after he's on the stage before he can reengage with people. And so yeah. I get that. I mean, that makes sense to me that you need to decompress and do your thing before you can be available for people. But I think there's something about celebrity that requires anonymity because it's an asymmetrical relationship you have with a celebrity. Like, you know all about them, but you have no relationship with them. And so mm-hmm. it kind of requires there to be anonymity of some true parts of who they are. Like, do you ever read Chuck Klosterman?
A little bit. Not too much, though.
He tells a story in his book, I think it's called I Wear the Black Hat, in which he talks about the subway vigilante from New York a few years back. This is before they clean up the subway system, and there's a lot of concern about crime on the subways. And there was a guy who was on there. Four young kids try to rob him, pulls out a gun, he shoots them all. And so he flees the scene, and they never really know where he is for the first week. And during that week, everyone thinks he's this hero. And even a couple people wrote articles comparing him to Batman, cleaning up Gotham City. And so they celebrated this guy because he cleaned up the streets and he was being Batman for them in their distress. But then he comes back into town. He goes to the police station. He turns himself in. He's cleared of charges, but people start interviewing and talking to him. And when they talk to him, they realize this guy's nuts. He's absolutely crazy. And so we don't want anything to do with him. But when they didn't know who he was, they were able to insert their narrative into his story.
Right,
you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely,
and celebrity
yeah.
kind of like requires that. Like, mm-hmm. I think as a musician, you get this with your songs. Like, people insert their narrative into your song. Make
right.
sense?
Yeah.
Like, your song, I listen to it all the time when my grandfather passed away, A Praise Chorus.
Okay, yeah.
And so I'm sure you didn't write that song for someone to remember their grandfather when he passed away.
Right, right.
But that became a song that meant that to me because of my narrative that I inserted. And so in some way, kind of like the celebrity thing requires anonymity so that you can insert this great narrative about how they're heroic and deserving of our adoration, right?
Yeah. No, I think that, I mean, and that's something we, you know, is, I don't write the lyrics. Jim writes the lyrics. But that's something that he tries to do is he tries not to be overly specific or even explain what songs are about. Because, you know, if you sort of place parameters of meaning around the song, then people aren't able to engage or interact with that song in their own specific way. So I think that's sort of along the same lines. It's like, you know, I think ultimately, you know, we have to judge people on their motivation depending on the sort of the how they behave just in general and not in just in specific instances, you know. And,
so you're like saying someone coming off stage isn't a time to determine if they're a celebrity or not. You're saying look at the rest of their life, right?
Well, yeah, look at how they interact, you know, look at how they make themselves available 24 hours a day, you know, not just, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, I think Richard's point is great. I just think a matter of, for me, it kind of comes down to the, you know, what motivates the artist, where is that motivation coming from? And I think, people who listen to the, you know, who judge the work of, you know, whoever's, whether it's an artist or a writer or a speaker, you know, you judge their work and you see how they operate and, you know, you can make your judgment, you know, sort of from the whole picture.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, what they do after they speak, because, you know, it's just different people have different, circumstances,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Some people are more extroverted. Some people are introverted. Like you're talking about, actually the pastor that Richard was talking to start the whole blog post is a friend of mine named Jonathan. And I know what he does every Sunday after he gets done preaching. he's energized because he's an extrovert. And so he'll write that very night his next week's sermon because he's energized by being around people. Mm-hmm. Others of us want to just be secluded and not talk to anyone the rest of the day because you're drained from spending time with people. And so everyone is everyone's different. Now, the second part of your point was the motivation that people have when they're approaching someone after their performance, whether it's speaker, musician, whatever. How can we determine what our motivation is? Is there like a litmus test that you've kind of gathered over your years of being able to say, yeah, this person's doing it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? What are some things that we can think about to determine kind of why we're going up to talk to the Richard Becks of the world after they present?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily an important distinction for us to make. I mean, I think I've been like that with, you know, other people. You know, I saw Jimmy Page at an after party of some award show in Europe. And I didn't care. I didn't care if he was going to be annoyed. I didn't care, you know, whatever. I walked up to him. It's like, you know, I said, man, I just, you know, just probably like some blubbering idiot. And, you know, I love your work and, you know, thank you. And you're such a hero, you know, and, you know, he probably gets that 20 times a day, if not more. So I think that on the one hand, it's you know, then there are other times where like I don't bother them. I just sort of like, you know, try to be respectful and whatever. But you know, I just think that I think that distinction is important, not so much to call people out for bugging celebrities, because in the end, if you're the, you know, what you do, like a guy like Jimmy Page, he has a pretty great life. You know, he has a lot of admirers. He has a lot of money. He has a lot of fame. And so like in that way, I mean, not to say that that equals a great life, but he has a lot of advantages, I would say.
Yeah.
And so there's just a cost to those advantages. And, I don't really know a lot of big, huge celebrities, but I've been around some, and it's really interesting to see how they, you know, like Dave Grohl is a great example. Like, you know, people will walk up to him and he's just super normal and nice and great. Like being around Dave Grohl, I know that he does that because he loves music. He's not doing it to get famous. He's not doing, you know, his heart is in the right place, you know?
Yeah. That's great to hear, because he comes across like he would be the guy you want him to be. I mean, that's, you think he's the embodiment of what like a rock star is supposed to be, even though I watched his documentary and his drummer was very specific that you don't call them a rock star. You wouldn't like that, but that's great to hear, because he seems like an awesome guy.
Yeah, he truly is. So, I mean, you know, I think, and then there's other people who I won't name, but you can just kind of tell they're not doing it for, like, their motivation just seems a little bit off. You know, they're doing it for something else, or they don't enjoy it and they just do it because they have to do it, you know? I don't know if it's necessarily a thing where people have to be conscious of why they're approaching people. You know, I would just say, you know, try to just like put yourself in their shoes. Like if they're eating dinner with someone else and, you know, don't approach them, you know, they're trying to enjoy dinner. But like, you know, it's just, it's funny. 2 weekends ago I was at a wedding and, one of my childhood heroes was at the wedding, John Bon Jovi. And I desperately wanted to like, just walk up to him and like, hey dude, what's up? Huge fan, you're a hero, you know? I had a few opportunities, but I didn't do it just because I don't want to be a dick. I don't want to bother him.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
Did you ever get to talk to him?
Yeah. It ended up that I'm like sitting at the bar ordering a drink, and he walks up right next to me and he's waiting, you know? And so, I ordered like a margarita, and it was taking the dude a super long time to make it. And I was like, and I apologize. Hey man, I'm sorry. I asked him to make like the longest, you know, the most time consuming drink possible. And he's like, oh man, no worries. And then we just started talking, and it just sort of, because he walked up next to me and we're both waiting for a drink, I just took advantage of the opportunity. You know, I think that, and it was a thrill for me because I'm a huge John Bon Jovi fan, but.
Of course. So do you drop the, hey, I'm in a band too. I'm one of you. I'm cool.
I told him I'm a musician. I play in a band. And, you know, I told him a story that, when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to watch MTV. And, you know, right around like fifth grade, I started, my mom was a teacher and she worked. So I had about an hour window between when my school got out and my mom got home. And I would get on my bike and I would book it home as fast as I could to watch the MTV Countdown. And they would, you know, they're, and that was the time when like Living on a Prayer, you know, just all the Slippery When Wet was like at its height. And so like there was just tons of Bon Jovi videos on MTV. And I would just, it was a huge, like I was a huge Bon Jovi fan, but I kind of had to keep it on the DL because, you know, I didn't want any, you know, anyone thinking I was worshiping Satan by listening to John Bon Jovi. So, so I told him that story, you know, and he asked me what band I was in. And so we talked about it, and we just got done doing a festival in Australia, and Richie Sambora was playing at the festival. So, we talked a little bit about that, but yeah, he was super cool. But I just think that, you know, I just think that from perspective of, you know, from where Richard's writing from and kind of making those judgments, I think it's important to say that, like, when there's a big difference, like, if I just want to stay in the Christian world, there's a big difference between, like, when Richard goes and does a speaking gig as opposed to, like, someone like a Rob Bell or a Mark Driscoll. Or, you know, like, you know, even though those two guys are totally different, they're experiencing this sort of same dynamic where people just want to, like, you know, go and bug them and attach, you know, and attach themselves to them because of their notoriety and because of their status. And, you know, that just feels, those just interactions aren't the best, you know.
No.
But when when Richard's hearing from people, he's hearing from people who are like, you know, Richard's not a celebrity. Like, I can't go and brag to my guys in the band that, oh man, I went and met Richard Beck, or I can't go, you know, people are like, who's that? You know?
Yeah. But, and he said that in the blog, he says he's not a celebrity like that.
And so, but I think for guys like you and I who are like massive Richard Beck fans, it's like, it's, you know, it's like meeting, you know, it's like a big deal for us, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's a big deal for a different reason, you know? And I think when Richard has those interactions, those are probably more pleasant interactions than if, like, you know, he were like a household name.
Yeah, and he's not getting stalkers. Yeah, he's not getting stalkers. There's something about like being a preacher where after the sermon, people want to come up to you and say how great the service was and how, you know, you changed their life. And it's a lot of preachers get that. And I heard one of my mentors tell me that what's going on is that people had an experience with God and they don't know who to go up and to be grateful for that experience to. They can't send God an email and say, hey, thank you for doing this great thing in service. It really made a difference in my life. Mm-hmm. And the same way a musician, like, there's a great experience and music is a gift. And as you talk about, you have this gift to use and you can't like write a letter to the universe and say, thank you for giving the gift of music. You have a person that was the distributor of the gift that's been given to them.
Right.
And so it makes sense. Like, you want to connect with the person who has been given this gift and they use it well and it's funneled through them, but you don't want to be a stalker, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a tough balance to figure out where that line is.
It is, you know, and you know, at the end of the day, like I sort of sympathize with when Richard is sort of saying, you know, just sack up and like go hang out with people. Like, if that's part of your job, it's, yeah, it's hard work, but there's a lot of other hard work. And, you know, I think that there's, you know, as someone who is, I agree that people who are, whether it's an artist or a musician or a speaker or whatever, like, they should sort of try to do the best they can, you know, to connect with people. And to do that, because it not only gives the person you're connecting with, you know, a good moment, and like you said, like the opportunity to say thank you, but it also like creates a connection between you and your audience. That's important, you know. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's something we try to do. At least, like, you know, we'll play a show and then we'll go sort of hang out in our backstage room and take a shower and whatever, like, you know, and we don't really hang out with people, or if there's friends, they'll come back of like maybe 20 minutes after we play. And then we go out to our bus, and there'll just be, you know, probably, you know, depending on the night, there'll be 30, 40, 50 kids out there. And, you know, we go and we sign whatever they want. We take pictures, but it's a little bit easier for us because we have that little bit of a buffer time. We have like that half an hour between when we're off the stage and then we go to our bus for the night. But, you know, doing that is important because, you know, even though we're not saying hi to everyone in the venue, we're saying hi to the people that waited around that really wanted to say hi. And that, you know, that's a sort of two-way street. Like, you're giving them that opportunity to take a photo and to hang out with them, but you're also creating a connection, you know, that is meaningful for them and that will, you know, they'll be sort of, you know, and typically fans are very reciprocal in that way. If you take time to do that, then, you know, they will, you know, stay with you moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun. But one of the things we like to do before we let people off the show is to give them a chance to play the Truth Plus Rumor game. Okay. Something we do here in the Newsworthy with Newsworthy podcast, because it's not newsworthy if it's not true. And so this is an opportunity for you to clear up a rumor that's been floating around on the internet about you. Now, one of the rumors is that you have a secret, unspoken animosity towards Richard because, I don't know if you saw this, but someone recently did a fan post of Lady Gaga, who is in the picture, and then there's a Richard Beck gospel according to Lady Gaga line superimposed over that. There's a rumor you're just upset because there's not one of those with you. There's not one gospel according to Jimmy World and not a picture of Zach Lynn tastefully nude with his quotes over. Is that true or false?
Yeah, that's false. That's false. Okay. I actually really like that post a lot. You know, I think that that's a great post. But I would also say that, you know, here Richard is giving Lady Gaga props for this. But then he should maybe apply his definition of celebrity with Lady Gaga and see who she's hanging out with after the show.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd want to hang out with her after the show. That might kind of scare me a little bit. But
one thing I just wanted to say, like, even though I'm pushing back a little bit on Richard's post, I think the sentiment of it is absolutely correct. And I think that Richard, for me, is the best blogger, the best thinker, that I know of today, in terms of Christianity, Christian theology. His book Unclean is insane. It's amazing. And it is, you know, the things he's talking about are so relevant and powerful. I'm shocked. I'm totally shocked that Richard is not a full-blown celebrity rock star in the Christian world, because he's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I know that you're a big fan of his. I'm a big fan of his. So, and truth be told, my dad was actually one of his first psychology professors back when he was just a junior college basketball player outside of Philadelphia. So
that's amazing.
He's been a family friend, and my dad actually works with him. So my dad's a psychologist as well. So I've known Richard for years, and he's kind of blown up, and that's great. But I know a lot more people should read his stuff because it's really
good. I mean, it's like it's mind blowing to me. Totally mind blowing to me that, like, you know, just the work he's doing right now is super important and very, very, very helpful.
Yeah. We might have to turn this podcast into the fanboy Richard Beck post or something, 'cause it's been a lot of love for Richard Beck here.
Oh, totally. Totally. And, you know, yeah, for sure. I'm down with that. I'll join that party anytime.
Well, I'll see if we can, if you guys ever do a show in Abilene, I'm sure we can get him to come to it, but I don't think you guys are doing any shows in West Texas anytime soon.
We might. We actually are doing some shows in Texas.
Oh, really?
In May. We're doing Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, and Houston. But there is talk of potentially adding a West Texas date.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
There's a few other shows that we're considering doing. Initially, we were just going to do those four shows, but we would need, just for routing purposes, we would need to maybe go through West Texas. So, so hopefully it'll work out. I'll push for Abilene. Any good places to play in Abilene?
You know, I went to school there, lived there for 7 years, and the answer is no. No, there actually is. There's a place called the Paramount. I was part of an interdenominational Bible study that actually met in it, and the venue's probably 800, maybe 1,000 seats. Pretty cool theater.
Okay.
You check it out. I'll give you the information off there if people don't want to hear us talking about that. Yeah. But anyway, hey, Zach, thanks so much for your time, man. People need to check out your stuff. You got good things going on. Follow you on Twitter. But thanks again, Zach. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.